ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Merry Christmas. Today, let's talk about love and other heart conditions, because over summer, I've been revisiting some of your favourite stories from 2025. So here's a chat I recorded live at the World Science Festival back in April, asking what's love got to do with it? It being the human heart, of course. This organ has been long associated with love, but why? Does a thing that pumps blood through our body actually have anything to do with the butterflies in our stomach when we meet someone special, or that connection you feel when you meet your baby for the first time? I've got the perfect crew to answer these questions. Human mating researcher Adam Bode, who's looking into the area of romantic love in his PhD studies at the Australian National University. Associate Professor Sonia Shah from the Institute for Molecular Biosciences at the University of Queensland. She looks at the links between heart and brain disorders. And Professor John Fraser, the founder and director of the Critical Care Research Group at the Prince Charles Hospital and the University of Queensland. And look, fair warning, I quote a lot of poetry and song lyrics over the course of this chat, so forgive me. Let's get into it. It feels like an appropriate introduction to our first chapter of discussion with some lyrics. I'm going to quote Tex Perkins from Aussie band The Cruel Sea, because we keep it erudite up in here. My heart is a muscle and it pumps blood like a big old black steam train. My veins are the tracks and the city is my brain. John, is this an anatomically correct description of how blood and veins work?
Am I going to get negative marked on this answer?
If it's not a steam train, I don't want to know about it.
Look, it's not a steam train. It's a fairly constant thing. It's an amazing thing. If you think our heart beats 80 beats per minute or perhaps 100 beats per minute as we walked on stage, and it does this every hour, every day for 80 years, you know, if this is a steam train, this is one of the best, most efficient steam trains you're ever going to feed. You know, we survive despite all the things, and the heart is necessary. It doesn't go to sleep. We go to sleep. It doesn't have a holiday. It just keeps on going. So very much a muscular sac, but also, and we've only realized recently, it produces a whole pile of hormones within the heart. So it actually changes the volume that stays inside you, whether you need to retain fluid or get rid of fluid. It does a whole pile of these things and then responds to a whole pile of hormones for the brains, for the fight or flight, which you were talking about the Egyptians and thousands of years. This response has been there for millions of years. You get chased by a lion or a Rangers fan in Glasgow, it's the same feeling. They're both wild animals and you have to get moving. So from a pulse rate of 60, suddenly you... And that's important. That's what keeps you alive. So, yeah, muscular sac, but lots of valves, lots of vessels, and really difficult to learn for exams.
And, like, everyone sitting here has one. Well, if they don't, you'll be able to explain what the loophole is there in a minute, John. But, Sonia, they're amazing. 99.9% of the time they work exactly as they should throughout entire lifetimes, but there are weaknesses too.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess unlike other organs that we have, like the liver, the intestines, or the skin, the heart can't regenerate itself. That means we can't produce new heart cells. And so anything that leads to injury in the heart or death of the cells, that's going to sort of, that injury is going to be there for the rest of your life. And it's interesting because we have that ability to regenerate when we're in utero, so when we're developing into a baby. But in humans and in mammals, that seems to switch off shortly after we're born. And it's not fully understood why, but I think there's a lot of interest in understanding what is that switch that switches it off, because that could really transform how we do cardiac medicine if we knew.
But that's still emerging.
That's still, yes, exactly.
So, of course, the link here is between the heart and love, Adam. I'm so interested in the fact that your research puts a really scientific lens on something that we think of as being very uniquely human, perhaps. How do you measure romantic love using the principles of science?
Sure. So before I respond to that, I should probably just clarify what I mean by romantic love.
Yeah.
So I explain it to people as that thing that happens at the beginning of a romantic relationship where you go a little bit crazy and think your partner is the best thing ever. I'm sure you maybe people in the audience might be able to remember back to a time when their partner was absolutely flawless. So science has two... It happens. So science has two primary ways of investigating romantic love. The first to develop was through the use of survey methods. In 1986, a pioneer named Elaine Hatfield and her co-author developed the Passionate Love Scale. Now, it's basically 30 questions that ask them about features associated with romantic love, like, do you think a lot about your partner? Do you find them very beautiful? Would you be very jealous if they fell in love with someone else? These sorts of things. And there's been a whole body of research that's developed over the last 40 or so years of people administering surveys to people who are in love and comparing them with people who are not in love or just people in romantic relationships. The second thread that's come out and starting in about the year 2000 is the biopsychology. So this is mainly neuroimaging, things like functional MRIs, positron emission tomography, and electroencephalograms. These are biological means of basically picturing the brain, taking images of the brain or measuring brain waves and seeing what parts of the brain are involved. There's also endocrinological studies which basically measure hormones or neurotransmitters in blood or saliva.
So we have validated measures of romantic love, and there is definitely biological processes happening when we're in it.
Without a doubt. So the first neuroimaging study by Bartels and Zecchi was taken in 2000, and they compared people looking at pictures of their loved one compared with looking at pictures of their friends, and they found a whole constellation of brain activity associated with looking at their loved one that wasn't there when looking at their friends.
So I can see you sort of nodding there. Is this something that you've seen in your own research?
Not necessarily in my research, and it's different to, I guess, sort of the effects of love. But William Harvey, who was a English physician back in the 1600s, he noted that any sort of emotions like pain and fear actually have physical effects on the body, but also on the heart and the brain as well. So, yeah.
So delving into some more song lyrics here, Gang of Youth say, because I want to overcome and try to love someone, because the heart is a muscle and I want to make it strong. So this idea of the machinery of our hearts, we do know it is a muscle. Adam, what is the point of love from an evolutionary point of view? Because I reckon if I asked people listening, they would have an idea, but there's a lot of pop science in this area. What do we actually know?
There certainly is. So it's hard to come up with the evolutionary functions of romantic love because it doesn't leave a fossil record like other things like bipedality do. But we can make
having two legs.
Walking on two legs. But we can draw inferences from modern behaviour. And love, like all types of love, and you've got to remember there's many different types of love, maternal love, love for our pets, people love sporting teams, there's all sorts of love. All of these types of love played a role in survival of the species. And that's part of the reason why love is so intense. It's because it's really important to make sure that we can live on and procreate. Romantic love played a particular role. And you've got to remember, 2 million years ago in the savannas of Africa, life was brutal. And getting pregnant and raising a child to an age where they could walk around and be relatively self-sustained was very challenging. So evolution over many hundreds of thousands of years developed this thing called romantic love to ensure that we could make a team of two working together to ensure the survival of the offspring rather than just the mother on her own.
Why not a bigger community? Like, humans are communal animals, and so many other animals are as well. Why is romantic love beneficial to us as a species and it was selected for in that way when there are other ways for societies to be?
So I don't think those other ways of societies to be don't exist. For example, there's many cultures today where large families and even whole communities play a role in taking care of the child. But at the very core, human reproduction involves a male and a female. And so too was a logical and efficient way of creating this team.
So John, I mentioned those lyrics before about the heart's a muscle and I want to make it strong. Does love actually do anything to your heart physically in a good way?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of research and it was fantastic. I was reading Adam's bio the other day and just going, suddenly my job title sounds really dull. You know, romantic love expert. There's no Glaswegians as romantic love experts. So the data's really quite clear. Like, you know, when you see someone, you fall in love, your heart gets faster, it pounds, your eyes brighten up, you vasodilate, you flush. But there's a huge amount of data that people in a relationship are happier versus a non-one. I looked at different papers and there's some fairly variability. And Adam's, it's great that, I think it's great that he's putting science behind it because there's a lot of fluff there. But one of them, it says that if you're married, you're happier. If you're not in a relationship, you're unhappier. But there's another study, and Adam can confirm or deny, that says marriage is great for men, maybe not quite so good for women. Sell down. Usher. But because it's harder, you know. But so people that are in love get less depressive illness. We know that loneliness is bad for you. We know that love or being in a relationship reduces your risk of infection, even pneumonia, which I didn't know. There's less hypertension, less blood pressure. But the other thing is, you know, things like a cuddle just give you oxytocin, give you some dopamine, give you a pleasure response. And there's nothing wrong with pleasure if you want to be non-scientific about it. It's a lovely thing, but sleeping in the same bed as someone makes people have deeper sleep. So they're pretty beneficial. I'd go for that.
So when someone's saying that their heart's skipping a beat or racing when they're in love, is that when you were sort of like, oh, I better have a listen to that? That sounds unhealthy.
Again, it's adrenaline, the sympathetic, the catecholamines, the same thing that if you're chased by that Rangers fan or that lion down the street, there's a benefit to this. But also, the heart has been given, I think, too much, to do with love. It's probably the brain stimulates the heart and then it's the heart gives you the external symptoms of it. But your heart definitely skips a beat. You can feel it. Your blood vessels vasodilate. You get warm, you get flushed. There's other places that the blood flow increases. So I've heard. But this is an ABC, not an SBS show. So we're not going there. Sorry, Tegan. But yeah, it definitely does. And all these hormones, and there's some of them. What I thought was fascinating was oxytocin is the hormone that the mum releases when she's going to breastfeed. But it's also a hormone that men and women get when they're in love. And it's unusual. I don't understand why it's the same hormone for letting you breastfeed, but a man has it as well. So it has two purposes, which I think is quite fascinating.
Sonia, you've done a lot of research in this link between the brain and the heart. What do we know?
So there is definitely a bi-directional relationship. So my research is mostly in terms of disease. There's a bi-directional relationship between psychiatric disease and heart disease. So individuals who have psychiatric disorders are more likely to develop heart disease, but vice versa, patients who have had heart failure or a heart attack also more likely to get depression. Now, the factors that might lead to that bi-directional relationship would be, there'll be several, and they might be different depending on that direction. But I guess if you're thinking about the effect of the heart on the brain, you can imagine that, you know, your heart, if the function of your heart reduces, that ability to pump oxygen around the body is reduced. So if you're not getting sufficient oxygen to your brain, that's going to obviously have an impact. And certainly patients with heart failure do have neurological symptoms like dizziness, nausea, fatigue. So I guess when it comes to, in that sense, it's important to treat the heart disease. But in those patients, it's actually important to provide that emotional support as well. But also there are sort of shared risk factors, and inflammation was one that was mentioned. It's been well known in heart disease, but there's growing evidence of its role in depression as well. But also I think the psychological factor is there. When you have heart disease, when you have a heart attack or you have heart failure, people do feel anxious about their future health outcomes. And there's a thing called cardiac blues, which patients sort of go through that feeling of sadness. So again, there's lots of different factors, and depending on whether you have heart disease first, or he have a psychiatric disorder first, they might vary.
What can we do if the heart's a muscle, is working it hard, strengthening it? Is it tiring it out prematurely? How do we think about it?
So there's two ways. I mean, hypertension, too much blood pressure, means that your muscle wall gets too thick, and that's a bad thing. But you want to protect it, you know, protect your heart from breaking. And the best way to do that is avoid McDonald's, avoid cigarettes, and move from the sofa to the sneakers, I think was the best phrase, from the foot sofa to the sneakers. So you want to look after it. You only get one. Like Sonia says, you don't get to remake heart cells. Once the heart cell's dead, you've got a scar, so the heart pumps less well. But more importantly, it's not just a sack of muscle. It's got a brilliantly clever electrical system. So once you scar a piece there, the electrical conduction can't go through, and it blocks it. So then you've got risk of funny heart rhythms, atrial fibrillation. Once you have this, your risk of stroke, again, the brain and the heart tied together, goes up 300%. So the simple things are, I mean, we do heart transplants and bionic hearts things, but the best way to do it is prevention, not a cure. The cheapest way to do it is prevention, not a cure. And it's things like going for a walk at lunchtime, avoiding Maccas and Siggies. And this is great when it comes from a Glaswegian middle-aged white male, because there's actually, and this is the perverse pride that we have, there's a postcode in Glasgow, G42, it's just up the road, and they've got a shorter life expectancy than North Korea and the Ivory Coast because of cardiovascular. We invented heart disease.
So you're a traitor to your kind, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I'm doing well. Once I got to 50, I got a telegram from the Queen. We don't get it when we're 100. We get it when we're 50.
Sonia?
I think, yes, it's important to look after your heart. But as I said, there is a brain-heart link. So it's actually really important to look after your brain and your mental health as well. John talked about, the fight and flight, which is your sympathetic nervous system, right? So it sort of prepares your body when it sees danger to either fight or to flee. But in modern day, even your sort of daily stress is sort of inducing the same reaction in your body, even though your life is not in danger. And when we have that constant sort of stresses in our life, that sort of puts that system into overdrive. And so those are some of the looking after both your brain and heart health is important. Yep.
Adam, we will talk about broken heartedness in a minute because I think that's a really interesting area. But I do want to get you to expound a little bit more on a different type of love that you mentioned earlier, which is maternal love. How does it manifest in the body and what do we see happening in the brain and heart?
Sure. So there's a lot of similarities between romantic love and maternal love. There's been a number of studies comparing brain scans of mothers with newborn infants and people experiencing romantic love, and it looks the same and different. The main similarity is activation of something called the ventral tegmental area, which is an almond-sized and shaped structure at the bottom of the brain that plays a role in processing social information. And it really lights up and projects neurons all the way through the dopamine reward pathway and to other areas that play a role in social processing and sexual desire and social cognition, basically telling the brain that this baby or information about this baby is really, really important.
So tell me more about oxytocin, because we hear about it a lot. We know it's sort of the love hormone. We heard you just mention it in terms of maternal love. John referenced it before in terms of breastfeeding. We also know it's involved in romantic love. How is this hormone acting in different ways in those different settings?
It's a bit of a conundrum because unlike other neurotransmitters or neurohormones, there's actually only one type of oxytocin receptor. So all this variety of activity that it plays a role in is a result of one type of neurohormone and one type of receptor. Research is developing, trying to give us a bit of an understanding of how it can play different roles, but we really don't know at this stage.
And then kind of building on that, this isn't something unique to humans, is it? Like, do other animal species seem to display love in the way that we would recognise it in humans?
I think anyone who's got a pet dog would know that their dog loves them back. So love is common throughout the animal kingdom. All mammals, for example, display maternal love. Maternal love is probably the prototypical type of love that the animal kingdom experiences. It probably emerged about 200 million years ago when the first mammals emerged. And the love that those mothers feel for their newborn offspring, you can tell they move around them, they feed them, they cuddle them, they protect them. It looks similar to what humans feel. In terms of romantic love, that might be a somewhat unique experience. So to experience romantic love, we have to pair bond. We have to shack up with one other person and form those long-term relationships. And that's pretty rare among mammals, maybe 3 to 5%, about 29% of primates. And so all of those species could feasibly experience something like romantic love. But the fact that our romantic love lasts 18 months or 2 years is really quite odd.
Is it short or long?
It's very long.
Oh, right.
Very long.
I mean, if you're hoping to be married for a few decades, it sounds pretty short.
You've got to remember, part of the purpose of romantic love is to form those relationships, not necessarily to maintain them. That's another type of love called companionate love, which is the love that long-term married couples experience, which is just as valid and just as important, but it looks very different when we're looking at people's brains.
Can you expand on that a bit?
So a lot of the extreme activity in romantic love isn't present. So we still have activity of some regions, like the ventral tegmental area, which I mentioned before, and another region called the anterior cingulate cortex. Both of these regions are active, but the extreme activity that you would see looking at someone wildly in love just isn't there.
I'm Tegan Taylor, and you're listening to a special edition of Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Over summer, I'm bringing you the best of 2025, and today is a chat from World Science Festival Brisbane back in April, three experts delving into the science of love. And you can't have a discussion like this without asking what happens to the heart when it breaks. So I asked Associate Professor Sonia Shah if there are physical symptoms that accompany the tears of heartache.
Yeah, so there is a syndrome called broken heart syndrome, or the sort of scientific name is Takotsubo syndrome. And it's essentially where the left ventricle, which is your main pumping chamber of the heart, the walls become weaker. And it's interesting that it's induced or can be triggered by emotional stress and extreme emotional stress. And it predominantly affects women from middle age to older women. And it's interesting that a large proportion of patients who have Takotsubo syndrome also have underlying psychiatric illness as well, so anxiety disorders and depression. So again, it's not fully understood the mechanisms of why this happens. But, I talked about the sympathetic system, and in these patients you get this sort of overactivation of the sympathetic system. But, we all go through daily stress, and a lot of people go through quite emotional, quite high levels of emotional stress if you've lost a loved one, for example. But Takotsubo syndrome is quite rare in the population, so not everyone's having that reaction. So it might be sort of a couple of things that lead to this broken heart syndrome. One is maybe the level of stress and that you have, but also perhaps a predisposition, again, to heart problems. And so in combination is probably what it takes to get to Takotsubo syndrome.
Is it potentially confirmation bias? Like, it's a very romantic idea that someone would be so bereft that their heart would fail. We don't want that for someone, but it's a very powerful story. Is perhaps the reason why we associate that syndrome with romantic love or loss of love, because it's something that does stick so deep for us as humans?
I suppose. But I think there are actually examples, and maybe you would know more, but are there examples that Takotsubo syndrome has also been induced by really extreme happiness as well? It's very rare, but I feel that there are examples of that as well.
I haven't seen a happiness, but you were challenging, about 2 years is not enough. I also think he's incredibly brave saying romance only lasts 2 years. And you think, someone's going to kill you. But he confessed beforehand that he's not married, so no one's going to kill him for saying, how dare you, only last 2 years. No, but we do see Takotsubo in intensive care. It's actually about 85% ladies. And I can still remember bed nine.
Bed nine.
poor lady had been to her husband's funeral. And the symptoms of Takotsubo are very, very similar to a heart attack. So you get chest pain. Sometimes it can go down your left arm. You feel sweaty, you feel nauseated, and you can collapse because the pump, as it's showing here, it's shaped like an octopus pot, a Japanese octopus pot, where the octopus can swim in, and then it's narrow at the neck and bulbous at the bottom, and that's in the heart. It looks almost similar. It's called apical ballooning. And then the small vessels can start to nip off. So this poor lady was at her husband's funeral. They'd been married for about 40 years, and she started getting chest pain, and she felt faint, and she got left arm pain. And to any medic or to anyone, you go, that's a heart attack, until proven otherwise. So she came into our ED, came into our ICU. We put a special pump in her leg because we couldn't work out what was happening. We then sent her to the coronary angiography table because it's indistinguishable. You think we need to open a blood vessel. And the angiogram showed her blood vessels were completely normal. But for the next 2 days, she was on the life support machine, a pump in her leg to help her heart, and then a pile of different drugs to keep her alive. And that, you know, that is a broken heart. She sat and she watched her husband's funeral and was so brokenhearted that she developed this condition. And it is reversible, so Takotsubo. So it takes these, but people can still die from it because it can be so severe. I haven't seen a happy Takotsubo. I don't know if we call it a happy subo.
No, so it's probably got not called the happy broken heart syndrome.
But, happy subo.
Yeah. But is it right that there are no treatments for sort of Takotsubo?
Oh, no. So this lady, you basically need to reverse what's caused it. So most of it's the catecholamines, the adrenaline is too much, and it causes the squish too much up at the bottleneck. And there's some discussion about whether it's the reactivity of the blood vessels, and that's maybe why it happens more in ladies. So ladies who are undergoing menopause will talk about flushes, and they'll get much more flushing than guys do at the same age. So the reactivity of their blood vessels, the microcirculation, is different. So the question is it a microcirculatory change? Unclear. But 89%, I think, was the figure I saw. So there are treatments where you reduce the effect of the adrenaline. So adrenaline makes your heart rate, when you fall in love, go fast, pump, 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 pump. So we give you beta blockers to go slow, 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 slow. Blood pressure tablets like ACE inhibitors. And in the very, very severe ones that we would see in intensive care, pumps to allow the blood vessels, the coronary arteries, to get fed enough oxygen. But yeah, that's one that sticks with me. This lady broke her heart literally at the funeral of her husband that she'd been married to for decades.
The woman in bed 9. So the treatment for what you're seeing there in that particular syndrome is different to the treatment that you would give if someone was having a classic heart attack.
Absolutely. So the question with a heart attack is aspirin and get the blood vessel opened as quickly as possible. So it's basically a mechanical, you know, the road is blocked and you're not getting enough oxygen. So anything, so if the blocked vessel, everything beyond that is not getting oxygen and it's dying, dying, dying. So time to opening the vessel is everything. But you can't tell the difference. So you have to go to the angiogram, then you go, And then it's a case of, okay, work out what else.
So emotional stress can absolutely lead to heart conditions, a heartbreak, you know, in inverted commas. What are some of the instruments or machines you're using to diagnose this? Because I know that the stethoscope's an old handy one, but technology has also advanced in the recent years.
Well, thanks for asking that question, Tegan. So we had the stethoscope's an amazing tool, and we all have one. We all like to carry it. Orthopaedic doctors don't know how to use it, but it means that they can bill more.
Side note, I have put a stethoscope on my knee before and it sounds horrendous. Orthopaedic doctors use them sometimes.
No, we do. And the problem with stethoscopes is you're listening to a sound. So what you're listening to is, when you're listening to the heart, is the valves, mostly the valves on the left-hand side. The mitral valve goes first and it's like a parachute. It's really quite complex. So it goes lub, and the aortic valve goes dub, lub, dub, lub, dub. You get... We did the world's largest science class once before, and we had about 3,000 children doing a rap version of the heart. It was pretty cool. So we definitely use this. But my good friend David Platts, who's one of the head cardiologists at Charlie's, we can do amazing things now with incredibly small things. So this,
I just have to. The little tomato sauce sachet that John's holding here is actually a packet of lube. What exactly
Never leave
you're
home
about
without
to trust
it.
John?
I'm not very good at... There you go. So this is an ultrasound that we can... So what we can actually do here is take your lube out. I'm so glad that this is radio.
He's unbuttoning his shirt. He's doing something.
We should shoot this late at night. And then what we can do is, I'm not sure we can take the lights down a little bit, we can actually see the heart moving. And then this is to show that Glaswegian men do have a heart. And then Platsy's, because I'm not very good at it, David's much better, we should get him up on stage. But we can actually see the direction of the blood. I don't know if people can see it. So you can see the red and the blue. And we can actually, we can determine how well your heart is functioning, how well your valves are opening, whether you need an operation. But the beautiful thing with this technology is the world doesn't just have heart disease in middle-class Brisbane. Queensland's an amazing state, but, you know, there is the... First Nations people, our cardiac disease rate is appalling. Part of that is genetic, we're talking about that, but also if you're further away from a hospital, if you're further away from someone like David Platts, you can't get this. Now with these techniques and with someone by Rolf Gomes, Heart of Australia, people out there can have an ultrasound down out there and have some expert like Platts to read it, and we can just take it in and actually say, you need to come into town and get an operation or you're fine. We did a lot of this through COVID and in Kenya, we do some of this and the reports come back. So this allows us to see how well the heart's pumping, how well the valve's doing, or if you've had a valve operation or we've started a new beta blocker on you, is your heart better for it? So it's becoming, this can actually just link onto your iPhone. So science is changing and getting smarter.
That is fascinating. So the sort of technology that you're talking about there, you're literally holding something the size of an iPhone and a little kind of microphone receiver. What was the previous generation of that technology? Like,
so the previous,
a big machine inside a big building.
A big machine that never left the city centre hospitals. So if you lived somewhere near Chermside, Prince Charles Australia's largest cardiac hospital, you were laughing. But the further and further you got from a city centre, and that goes also with socioeconomic class. So, but we know that the burden of cardiac disease is much higher. The burden of mental illness is much higher. And these things, as Sonia said, the association is huge. But we need to get the treatment out there, not just in here. We need to democratise healthcare, both within Australia, First Nations people and everyone else, but also low-middle-income countries across the world, because we can do it. You know, people, I'm back and forward to Kenya and Uganda, everyone's got an iPhone. Like the incidence of phones there is amazing. They're brilliant communicators. So it's doable, and if you've got a Wi-Fi signal and an iPhone kind of thing, it can be done.
Sonia, the democratisation of healthcare is a really big part of your work.
Yeah, so as John said, that heart disease does impact different populations differently. But there is, in part, there is a genetic difference in genetic risk as well. But a lot of the data that we have and the research that we do, that data comes from mostly people of European ancestry. So, and in a lot of studies on cardiovascular disease, you have a bias towards men. So our knowledge around cardiovascular disease is very much biased towards men of European ancestry. And so I work in the genetic space, and one of the things we're interested in is looking at genetic risk. Can we predict who is at high risk based on their genetics? So, as I said, the data is mostly from European ancestry, but when we try and apply or that predictor to other populations, it loses accuracy. And so there is a big need to ensure that there is diverse representation in our research, in our clinical trials. And as I mentioned, one of my focuses is on understanding differences in men and women. And we know treatments can vary as well by your gender, but also by your ancestry. So there was actually a big sort of lawsuit in America where the state of Hawaii sued a pharmaceutical company which developed a drug which was a blood thinner. But a large proportion of Pacific Islander populations, South Asian populations, actually carry a genetic variant that essentially reduces the efficacy of that drug. And so it was marketed without that information. And so people off those ancestries were taking the drug thinking it's going to be helping them, but actually it was quite ineffective. So that's probably one of the biggest losses that happened either last year or the year before. So again, it's really important that we have diverse representation in all the research that we're doing.
And that needing of that critical mass and that collective action to actually to show that up and to hold those people to account.
Yeah.
It's interesting, even a bigger one was aspirin. So aspirin is one of the primary drugs for heart disease, but the same thing. In the 70s and 80s when they did it in white men. And then in the 90s and 2000s, they went, oh, it doesn't work as well on black men. But we just assume because it did pulse oximetry, where you put the little pulse oximeter on your finger to look at your oxygen level. No one bothered looking to see whether it worked with people with colour. And then we showed in COVID, where, again, the burden of disease was much higher in poor people with from different ethnic backgrounds, it's 3 or 4% wrong. So at the moment, we're looking at just pulse oximetries in First Nation people who have got a higher incidence and a higher burden of heart and lung disease. And we've done nothing. And we keep saying, well, I need to make this better. We'll check them out in proper studies and make sure the technology we're going to work, we're going to use works for them.
It's a story, it feels like it comes up in almost every single part of health and science of health. Adam, I'd love to come back to something that you mentioned before about the different types of love, because you accused romantic love of only lasting a couple of years. John seemed to take that personally. But I'm interested to hear to know more about that companionate love that you mentioned, and if that's still a driver of broken heart disease. I'm sure the woman in bed 9, it wasn't 1 or 2 years into her relationship and she had such a strong physical response. What do we know about that companionate love and its effects on our hearts?
Sure. So the normal progression is that we become attracted to somebody and we fall in love with them. And this lasts, if everything goes well, 18 months to 2 years. And it slowly dissipates. It slowly dissipates and this companionate love takes on. And it's still associated with many of the things that romantic love is associated with. So dopamine activity, lots of oxytocin activity. And it plays a really important role in behaviour as well. The way we treat our long-term romantic partners is very different to the way we treat our friends or people that we have just met. So it is probably the most defining characteristic of human love, I'd say. Maternal love is descriptive of mammals. Companionate love is probably descriptive of humans. Certainly that woman in bed 9 would have been experiencing companionate love. And often this builds up over many decades or even longer. And part of the struggle that people have with losing someone that they have been in a relationship for so long with is that they become reliant on that person to complement their life. Often that person will do the things that that person doesn't do. Often they will benefit from the things that person does. And when this happens for 40, 50, 60 years, you can just imagine the strain that places on the mind and the heart.
And then the other side of it is, I mentioned Romeo and Juliet before, and that incredible fizzing passion of a very first love, and especially in teenagers. Is there something about that time of life or that first love being young that makes that such an incredibly physical, strong experience?
So we know very little about first experience of romantic love. I'm actually involved in a study working with some colleagues in Poland that is comparing people who have fallen in love for the first time to people who had fallen in love multiple times. And we expected that the intensity of romantic love might be greater in first-time romantic love. We didn't actually find that. But what we did find is that first-time romantic lovers obsess about their partner a lot more. So they're thinking for 50, 60% of their waking hours about their loved one compared to a smaller amount for people that have fallen in love multiple times. The other thing we found was that first love was associated with more commitment. So I think that's probably, based on my personal experience, very indicative of what a first love was like. I'm going to be with you for the rest of my life and nothing's going to change that.
Undoubtedly.
Until something does.
I married my first love, so here we are. Talk to me about the shape of your heart. to quote another song lyric, we know what a heart looks like. John just showed us before, actual heart in our chest. We know that we associate it with love, but when we talk about it with love, normally if I'm like writing in emojis, I'm writing this sort of very cute, like curved shape, two lobes at the top, a pointy base. I'm not drawing like veins and whatnot. Why does it look like that?
So I don't know why, but I can tell you a little bit about the history of how we came to this state. So the first use of that sort of shape came about in about 1250 in a piece of French literature called Roman de la Poix, which translates to Romance of the Pear. And in the story, the protagonist presents to his loved one a pine cone in the shape of the love heart. And that's the first documented case of somebody. Well, why
that's
he did that?
It's not even a pear.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pine cone.
I have to admit to not having read it. But over the subsequent 300 or 400 years, that shape became associated with love, and the color red and pink became associated with the shape. And it wasn't until about the early 1800s that it became associated with Valentine's Day. And since that time, you've had Cupid's arrow going through it and all sorts of things.
And how do you, so we haven't really given you a chance to talk about your survey. Talk to me about how you actually go about digging up this information.
Sure. So I was lucky enough to do a PhD on a topic that I just found interesting. I mean, romantic love sounds interesting to study. And part of my PhD, I was required to collect data to undertake some survey analyses. And so I created with my supervisor, Phil Cavanagh from the University of Canberra and the University of South Australia, the Romantic Love Survey 2022. And we basically asked 1,500 people from North America, Europe and South Africa who claimed to be in love a whole range of questions about their relationship characteristics, their demographics, personality, their mood, sexual activity and romantic love. And that's created what is essentially the world's largest data set of people experiencing romantic love from which we can draw a whole number of studies.
So bearing in mind what Sonia was just saying before about genetic differences among different racial groups, people of different biological backgrounds, do you think that if you could expand it, you'd perhaps find different things among different cultures?
So my survey data, combined with other studies that have been undertaken, we've identified cross-cultural differences in the way people experience romantic love. And this could be a result of ethnic genetic differences, or it could be a result of the environment, or more likely a combination of both. So there's certainly going to be some variation across ethnic groups, and there's definitely some differences across countries.
Hey, it's Anthony Burke here. Radio National presents The Homefront. Housing in Australia is under pressure. The crisis is real. But could better design be part of the fix? I'm Anthony Burke, and in The Homefront, we explore how the great Australian dream is shifting and what we could do to build a better future. To hear The Homefront, search Radio National Presents on the ABC Listen app.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I hope you are having a great Christmas day. You're listening to a chat I had at World Science Festival Brisbane back in April on the science of love. And so far, we've talked about all the different ways a heart can break. So I asked John Fraser, who's the founder and director of the Critical Care Research Group at the Prince Charles Hospital, how to heal a heart.
Heart disease is the biggest killer, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So we have lots of medical treatments, but the end stage is end stage heart failure. And treatment has got much, much better, but we still have a growing, as we grow older, we used to die when we were 40 and 50 and 60, and it ties in a little bit to one of the theories I read about romantic love, that it's like letting a flat, you would stay with a partner for long enough till you could rear the child, and then roughly we would die. But we don't do that anymore because it lasts for longer than 2 years, Tegan.
People like you guys keep us alive for longer.
So then the question is, how do we keep you alive if your heart had, despite all the great stuff? So heart transplantation is a huge area and it saves lives, and it's one of the most beautiful things, I think, in medicine, not just the science, but you need a donor who has gone through the worst time in their life Someone's going to die, their loved one's going to die, and then we have to go and say to them, would you like us to take an organ out of your mum, your dad, your brother, your sister, your partner, and give it to someone that you will never meet, that you will never benefit from, but you will give them the gift of life? We, out of 100% of the hearts that we're offered, there's probably about three quarters of them that we can't use. Part of it is because this vast brown land is huge. So it means, like one of our patients, if you're in Perth, we had a wonderful 23-year-old girl called Alex who was doing her PhD. The number of donors in Perth is tiny. And about 6 years ago, we started saying, how can we make, again, this more democratized? How can we use more of these hearts that people are offering up in their saddest moment? So we started working on our rig. Instead of just plumping it on ice and going as quickly as possible, what about we can perfuse that heart with oxygen and blood? We can give it some medical Gatorade to keep it going. So the oxygen's going into the muscle because muscles all need oxygen. Carbon dioxide's coming out and we can perfuse it with stuff that keeps the cell alive. So for about 5 years, our group at the Critical Care Research Group in Charlie's and Platsy was part of it, and we worked in the lab and we showed that we could get in the lab from 4 or 5 hours up to 10 hours. So after the study in the labs, we said, this works. And with David Kay, David McGiffin, led from the Alfred and ourselves, we did a study across Australia and we did 36 humans transplanted off it. And normally once you get to 5 hours time outside the body, your mortality is 1 in 5. We got up to 9 hours and had 100% survival.
Oh, wow.
So suddenly by taking the technology, we can use more hearts, more mums and dads get to see something good come, more people like Alex, who was 24 doing her PhD, live, and the hearts arrive in better nick by the use of science pushing forward. And it's been a wonderful thing. And this, you know, we did here with all the different hospitals, and credit to them, but mostly credit to the donors. And this is, you know, the work in Australia has changed the way that transplant happens around the world. And it's one of those lovely things that you can help that person, that family, and that family, and the rest of the world goes, oh, Australia. We thought they had a harbour bridge, koalas, and a big rock. But it's lovely to go to America and do that.
No, I got to meet Alex, who was the recipient of that heart, and just such an incredible story. She talks about the fact that she woke up from that surgery feeling like a brand new person the moment she woke up. I think I expected her to say that it was going to be a really long recovery, and she was like, nah, felt amazing the minute I woke up. She'd been in heart failure. So coming back to the metaphorical broken heart, and Adam, you know, where people lose loved ones, how do we respond and recover emotionally from heartbreak?
Sure. So there's been a bit of research into people who have been rejected in love is the way the scientists talk about it. And one of the important neurohormones and neurotransmitters involved in love is the opioid system. And we do become sort of addicted to our loved ones. In companionate love, for example, they are the steady thing that is always there, and we get a little bit of a hit and we feel all right. And
build up a tolerance to them over time, though, as well.
Well, interestingly enough, we think beta endorphin may be the opioid that plays a role, and that's the one endorphin that you don't develop a tolerance to. So I need more of you might ring true. But we think that breakups or loss of a loved one through death, a form of grief, is somewhat akin to an opioid withdrawal. So heroin addicts report a lot of symptoms very similar to people undergoing breakup. So can't eat, can't sleep, crying spells, those sorts of things.
But like some people seem to bounce back more quickly than others.
Everyone's different. So psychology comes into play, attachment styles come into play. So your predisposition towards being comfortable with your partner or being anxious about them or being dismissive of them is going to play a role. I know my first love, I ended up breaking up with her after about 2 years.
I
It was her loss, Adam.
That's what I thought, but she's her loss, mate. Her loss. Next week.
Oh, that's cold.
Yeah, so everyone's different. Time is going to be the one thing that is probably the best predictor of when you're going to start to feel better. I mean, anyone who's lost a loved one through death knows that grief does get better over time. For some people, it does linger, but time is going to be the thing that helps.
And we were talking, but this is going to go somewhere pretty heavy, just for a moment, but we're talking a lot about romantic love, you know, losing a partner, breaking up, whatever. But you also talked before about maternal love. The grieving process and the recovery process, how is that different for someone who's lost a child?
Yeah, so there is theoretically no greater loss than a mother losing her newborn child at any stage. The type of love is so intense and has evolved over 200 million years to be really, really strong. It is the most important type of love we experience. It's absolutely atrocious, but it does have some similarities with the sort of love people in love, the sort of pain people in love might feel. It's the opioid system, a type of withdrawal, the loss of oxytocin, dopamine going haywire. It's some similarities.
Sometimes when I'm really unwell with a virus and you're sort of feeling really rubbish and you kind of go, oh, well, I know it's my immune system responding to this virus and going to get it out of my body. In a similar way, do you feel, Adam, that understanding what's happening inside your body when grief is occurring is maybe useful for people to understand, to know what's happening to them, even if they're in a lot of pain, perhaps it can help them deal with that pain?
I have no doubt. I mean, it's a type of mindfulness, isn't it? When you're experiencing these distressing experiences and you can pinpoint, oh, that's this going on, is probably helpful. I'm not aware of any research, but I would be surprised if there's not research looking into psychoeducation for people who are undergoing grief, and that being a useful and important therapeutic intervention for people in that situation.
So speaking of education, Sonia, your research is currently looking at DNA to see what it might tell us about keeping a healthy heart. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us that we can sort of take away today?
So in my research, we analyse large data sets where we have genetic information on individuals, but we also have information on their health over time. And so what we can do is we can compare the DNA sequence between people who do have a disease and people who don't have the disease. And what we're trying to do is identify sequences that are more common in people who have disease, because that then points us towards regions in our genome that might be important for disease development. And we can even identify the specific genes that might be involved. And so how does that help us and stay healthy? I guess one of the ways you take that information forward is you can use it to develop new drugs to treat heart disease. And some of the work we've done has been on heart failure. So a few years ago, I co-led the first large-scale genetic study of heart failure. And that's been an ongoing collaboration. But what's interesting that has come out from that is from the genes that we identify that are important for disease, we can also map them to where they're expressed in the body. So what tissues are they expressed in? And of course, we find that there are genes that are mostly expressed in the heart that come up. But interestingly, in heart failure, we also see for different types, subtypes of heart failure, we actually see other tissues coming up, and brain tissue is one that has come up. And kidney is another one that has come up as well. So that's some of the interesting findings. But as I talked about, was the risk predictions we're also interested in. And so we can then take those regions in our DNA, and I can take your blood, sequence your DNA, and I can then calculate your risk of getting a particular disease. And so most people will have average risk in the population, but then you have, it's like a bell distribution. And so you have extremes of the population who are at much, much higher risk. And so, as I said earlier, this is present from birth. It doesn't change across your lifetime. What changes is your lifestyle, right? So heart disease is a combination of your genetics plus your lifestyle. And so if you know much earlier on that you are at really high risk, you can actually make those changes in your lifestyle to try and prevent disease.
Thank you so much to human mating researcher Adam Bode, looking into the area of romantic love in his PhD studies at the Australian National University, Associate Professor Sonia Shah from the Institute for Molecular Biosciences at the University of Queensland, looking into the links between heart and brain disorders, and Professor John Fraser, the founder and director of the Critical Care Research Group at the Prince Charles Hospital and the University of Queensland, for joining me for this chat, which was illuminating and so much fun. That is Life Matters Today on ABC Radio National. I hope you're having a beautiful Christmas and that you enjoyed this chat from World Science Festival Brisbane on the matters of the heart. I hope your heart is full today. You can catch up on any of our stories on the ABC Listen app, and Life Matters will be back here again with you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.